It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 685. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message on Skype. The name is Mike Tech Show, all one word. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/miketechshow, and Facebook, facebook.com/miketechshow. This show is brought to you by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers unattended and on demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking on the link on my website at miketechshow.com. Use the promo code MikeTechShow for your free 15-day trial, and you can also go directly to instanthousecall.com. We'll be talking more about Instant House Call throughout the show because I was using that all day yesterday as I worked from my chair that I sit and record this show. Tonight, I got five stories from the trenches. I'm going to talk about connecting a manufacturing system to the network that I did remotely with a client, which was not easy. Locking down a peer-to-peer Windows 7 system. Job accounting on the Carisia multifunction, but for a Mac. What a nightmare. And when I tell you the trick, you're never going to forget it. Credential manager, how to fix some problems for a client with that. And then another, I thought it was a GoDaddy hack for a client, but it wasn't. And I was really glad. And I'll explain what happened. And then I got three emails. So let's get started. We'll work backwards. So last night, I spent a few hours with an engineer on site, one of my clients. They have these big fabrication machines for thermoforming, and they rely on a USB port to connect a they put the programs that have the code for what the machine's going to make for the instructions, and that USB port broke. There is a device that they haven't hooked up to give it Ethernet capability. Now, we were lucky from this machine, there was a line all the way back to the server room that was tested and working, but they were using it for something else. It's now available. He plugged that in at both ends, and now it was a matter of configuring the system to work to be able to communicate and send files to it. Now, I thought that this networking would allow us to communicate directly to the system and put files on the system. But I don't think there was a hard drive built in for this. So there's no storage. So there was a section called NetShare. And I finally figured out, took us a couple hours, I created a share on a system in the engineering department. They actually use that for a license server for some of their design packages that has to go through this license manager in order to work. So I created a share, created a local account, gave it the permissions, but something we learned the hard way in doing some research, for this machine, all of the entries, when you put the host name of where it's going to connect, because we thought that that was the host name we were going to connect to, but it was the exact opposite. So we put the host name, the username, the path, the password, and it had to be all capital letters. We read that obscure information online. Everything has to be caps. So once I created that on the system, it was like magic. He could see the files and was able to pull them, and they can now reactivate and get this machine going. To have a tech come out and work on that machine and repair the USB port, they were quoted $20,000. What I did last night, for a couple hours, we saved $20,000. That was an incredible savings that I want to cement my value for that client. They've been a long-term client now, which has been great. And I end up getting involved in so many different areas of the business and helping with IT. I thoroughly enjoy it and love having a real manufacturing client. Feel like I'm contributing and really doing something with my contributions to the organization. So that was last night. So it ended on a nice up note. So let's keep going backwards for yesterday. My son was on site for this company. They have a peer server that they need to lock down because there's other groups that are coming in that are doing work for them, but they don't want them to access this peer server. Now, this is a company that really needs a real server that we can lock down permissions. It was kind of open a little bit. So what we had to do with my son on site, and he was doing regular maintenance on all the computers, and this site, 30, 35 computers, and my son's doing the regular maintenance. Wednesdays, they're slow day, so out of the 7 days of the week, so that's why we'll do maintenance during the day. He's there all day. I was remote, and I had to build a map. If you want to lock down a Windows 7 peer server, you have to turn off the option for no passwords, and you got to make sure that you need an account and a password in order to connect. So I had to change some of the networking setup. And now the way to go about this was we first built a spreadsheet that lists the users, what machine they're connecting to, what will be their server name to connect, the password, and then what they need access. Once I had that, and my son really got that recon the week before, I planned out what I was going to do. So first, you have to map this out. Once you have that, I started creating a group for each application or set of files. Let's say one of the shares was faxes. So who needs access to the faxes when they come in on that share? There's only a handful. So I created a group, a local group called faxes, a local group for each application, and a local group for scans for different file accesses. So I ended up with like about 10 different local groups. There was only 7 users that really needed access. So then I created a local user account for the 7 users. Now, I put those users that need access into the groups. So, local users into the local groups. Then I applied the local group to be full permissions for that particular share, that application, or whatever directory they needed access. So, I gave my son a warning that I'm ready to turn this on. There are people that are going to have a problem, and now he's on site to take care of this, especially those 7 users. Anybody else I don't care about because they're not supposed to access anything. So now those 7 users, my son's ready, and when I applied all the permissions, he had to visit each one, and one of the things, after a reboot, the person still had trouble when he tried to map them with the new credentials. That's because there was already a drive mapped with different credentials. You cannot map 2 different credentials to the same Windows server, especially a peer server. You cannot do this. So when you map a drive as another account, which is what we're doing here, he disconnected the drive, rebooted, remapped. With the new credentials, everything worked perfectly. And we did that. He went through the 7 people, and the system is completely locked down. So that was one of our biggest jobs yesterday to make happen. I was doing this remote while I was remoted onto the peer server and different workstations. Now, step 2, They use job accounting on the multifunction systems. They have two Carisia printers. And I don't know if this is common for all multifunction printers, but if you're a Mac and you need to print using job accounting, where there's a number that's assigned to that person to print for permissions. In Windows, it's a piece of cake. In the driver, in the manager for any printer, never had a problem. There's always a job accounting. You check the box, put the number in. It's easy. But on the Mac, it is very frustrating. I am trying everything to get to these screens to, I just want to see a job accounting option. And I downloaded the latest driver. No joy at all. So I contacted the company that has the service contract to support them. Guy sent me the instructions. They didn't work. Okay, I got the file to download, but the second half of the instructions, the screens that there had screenshots, I'm not seeing them. So I get the guy on the phone and we agree on a time, 3 o'clock. I'm remoted in instant house call. He's remoted in with another product and we're both in at the same time. Guess what? He discovers his instructions aren't working. He has to get Kyocera support on the phone. When I tell you what the answer is, not every application on the Mac responds the same way on the print options and settings, even though it's the same driver. Every application presents itself with a different set of preset options. And you have to try every application till you get to one that allows you to save a preset that gives you job accounting. And then and only then you save it for all printers, and then it will work for the printer and no matter whatever application you're using. Kyocera said you have to have either Microsoft Word or Adobe Acrobat Reader. They're the only two applications that will allow you to see that. Now, this Mac user, and there's a new group of five other Macs that there's a little department now of, and there's six of them that have Macs, and they need to participate in these printers, and they have to have all different job accounting numbers. Well, none of them have Word. They use Pages or they use something else. So we had to download Adobe Acrobat Reader, which is free, and put it on every Mac. And then, and only then, could I find the options for job accounting. And that's the tip. If you run into a situation, I don't care what the printer is, and you find that you have to put a job accounting number, and you can't, and it's driving you crazy, download Adobe Acrobat Reader, because that seems to give you those options. And then once you set them, and it even tells you, do you want to set this for all printers and all applications? You say yes, and then that's it. It's done. So even if you print from text edit or a browser, it'll use the proper job accounting code. Very strange. The minute I heard that, I'm like, oh, that's going on the show tomorrow night. Next problem. We keep going back. Earlier in the morning, ran into a problem with Outlook. Now, this, I've ran into this a couple times, so I knew exactly where to go. If you have Outlook, especially Outlook 2016, and you are connecting from one profile to multiple hosted Exchange accounts, especially when some of them are hosted at the same place, you run into a problem where sometimes you're disconnected from the server, from the Exchange server. And this, you have to use Windows Credential Manager. I have a link to help guide you through the process. This is where Windows stores passwords and login details. And I have a great link, I'm putting it in the chat, that I'm going to have in the show notes that will walk you through editing or creating an entry. So what I found was that the user entered the wrong account and password, but for a different login. He got confused. He thought he was being prompted for account A, and he entered the credentials for account B. And that confused Outlook. So once I went through Credential Manager and seen what was entered the last couple days, I was able to remove some of those credentials and then properly add the right ones. And like magic, he launched Outlook and he says, oh, it's connected. That's it. So it took a couple minutes. But whenever you get a problem with authenticating and trying to connect to something online like that, maybe it's Office 365 or it's Microsoft or any Exchange hosted systems, don't forget about Windows Credential Manager and go in there and take a look at what the password is, what the login is, and maybe re-enter the password just to make sure. And maybe remove it and then recreate it. That has saved me a few times. So since I had to do that yesterday, I wanted to mention that. Something else from yesterday. This is all from yesterday. Got a panic phone call in the morning when my other title insurance company said, we're not getting any email. I logged into their email. I'm like, I see it. She says, go try to send yourself a new message. I sent and it didn't appear. I'm like, what's happening? And I didn't get a delivery failure. I thought their GoDaddy DNS was hijacked or hacked because I went to MX Toolbox, put their domain in, and there was no MX records. And they're a Google G Suite, so there should have been all of the Google mail records. They were not there. I said, hang up from me, call GoDaddy right now. Now, there was a piece of information missing that I didn't know. And when we talked a few minutes later, see, GoDaddy's no longer hosting their DNS. And I didn't know this, or at least the name servers. They had a new web developer that moved the domain name and did not, and shame on them, and I don't know who they are even, they did not migrate the MX records. How can that be? That means if they transferred the domain, you know, the name servers are still pointing back to GoDaddy, so everything still works. But once you take ownership of the domain, you better have those manual entries that you can put in there to preserve all of the other records. What about the auto-discover record? What about the SPF record? They didn't have any of that. I provided the owner with all that information, and I said, they got to populate this. And I said, oh, by the way, you no longer own your DNS. I said, because I don't even know what hosting provider it was. Well, I'm not going to share it. And then what if they are not able to even do the DNS because maybe they got to submit a ticket for the DNS changes because they bought it from ABC company that's not an official registrar. And so they don't even have the control of the DNS. It just gets ugly. And here's my advice. And I think anybody who's listening here does consulting and work like we do, you know this, but if you don't, this is something to always remember. I run into this a lot with a lot of my clients where they have DNS, we own it, whether it's Network Solutions or GoDaddy, and their web developer wants to control the name servers. And I'm like, no, give me the IP address of the website and I will enter the A record for our client. And I get a little resistance from the web developers, but the web developers, no offense, maybe you're a web developer and you're listening and you understand DNS. 90% of the web developers I run into, they do not understand DNS properly. And that's why I can't let them take control of it. So I always want to be informed or involved when that's being transferred or moved or being done, so I can weigh in. Now, I have a lot of clients that know this and would not think of doing anything without engaging me. Well, this client didn't. And then, look, they had a mail outage for the morning by not just reaching out and letting me know that the change is being made. A lot of people just think it's like buying that multifunction printer. Oh, we don't need to let our IT guy. We don't need to let them know. You're buying a device that's going to be on the network that everybody's got to print to it. You're going to scan to it. You're not going to involve your IT guy. Does it make sense? And I've run into this so many times. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. You got to involve us. I'm not going to charge someone for the 5 minutes of me weighing into a change that they're thinking of making. Better to involve me like a great example. Malwarebytes is prompting them for an update. They're afraid to click on that without me weighing in. I get a text, Mike, I'm getting this with a little picture, and it's a legitimate Malwarebytes saying it wants to do the upgrade. I said, you go right ahead. Or it's another antivirus program, and it's coming up. Should we do this? Should we? I like that. I don't mind my clients asking me, then clicking on something, and bad things happen. Like, they go to a website, and all of a sudden, the browser's talking to them, saying that their system's infected, and dial this 800 number right away. I've had clients where I could hear the computer talking to them in the background. Mike, should I call this 800 number? No. Close the browser. Let me log in. Try to get to log in. If I can't log in, I say, shut the computer down, and either me or my son's going to be on site, and we're going to fix it. I was really glad to hear that the GoDaddy wasn't hijacked, and there was a technical reason of what happened. But given the events that I talked about a couple weeks ago, you know, my radar is up. Anytime email's not working, the first thing I look at is the DNS. Hey, what's going on? And has that been hijacked? Or did their domain expire and they didn't renew it? You know, there's lots of explanations for especially email. Did the credit card change? And did they ignore the warning? That happens to a couple clients where their credit card changed for their monthly billing and they didn't go in and update, and they got a couple warnings, but they ignored it. All of a sudden, mail suspended. You know, you got to update the credit card. Have some email. This is from our friend Kevin, the computer doctor. Hi, Mike. I'm a few episodes behind, but recently listened to the troubles you had with your on-prem to off-prem exchange migration and the auto-discovery troubles you had. Microsoft has a utility that may have helped, and I've used it a handful of times. I gotta admit, I've talked about this utility a long time ago, but I forget to go to this. So I'm going to have a link to this in the show notes. It's called the Microsoft Support and Recovery Assistant for Office 365. Even though it specifically says for Office 365, it does have some Outlook-specific functions that have ironed out odd kinks I've come across in migrations in the past. With that being said, I've not done an on-prem to SureWeb like you were. We only deal in Office 365 via AppRiver reselling, so I can't say that it would have helped. It also has a function that specifically deals with Outlook asking over and over again for a password. That in itself is a great. I'm wondering if that utility actually goes in and makes the credential manager change. I bet you it does. To fix that asking for the password over and over. Kevin, great. Thank you for the link, and I'll have that in the show notes. This is from James. Is there such a thing as a USB 3 adapter that will let me take USB 3 equipment to my otherwise USB 2 desktop PC? Mileage varies here. I have lots of equipment and lots of devices and USB sticks that are branded USB 3, but they do work on USB 2. I don't know. I think there's cables, but I don't know if there's a direct conversion, like that you need a 3-to-2 cable. I don't know of any like that. It's really hit and miss. Does that device, does it downshift to USB 2? Not sure. But I've had some great success with using three devices on a USB 2 and vice versa, USB 2 on USB 3. Now, you want to match it perfectly if you're doing some big file transfers. You want to have the SS beside the USB port, or it's usually blue. Not all manufacturers carry that blue standard, but you might see SS. A lot of Dell systems have that. And then a USB 3 external drive or USB stick, and now you're going to get maximum throughput for USB 3. James, I hope that helps. This question is from Martin. I was listening to show 684 regarding upgrading from Windows 10 Home to Pro. I know this technique works great for upgrading from Pro to Enterprise and should also work for Home to Pro. And here's how I do my upgrades. Open Control Panel, open the Systems icon, select Change Product Key, enter the Windows 10 Pro key. I'm going to stop right there and interject. I know for a fact I've had zero success rate doing that. I personally, last year, had multiple systems that I could not go directly from Home to Pro. I'm going to tell you what I did. He continues, this will cause Windows to upgrade itself to Pro and should only take a few minutes. When done, you now have a Windows 10 Pro machine. No reinstallation of any other software required. Okay, that, at least for me, has not worked. So I have had a couple systems, including some HP mini computers, that came here as 10 Home, and I had legitimate 10 Pro keys. It did not work. The only way an older system will allow you to work, where that means Windows 10 is not in the BIOS for Windows 10 Home. The only way you can do this is first you have to upgrade to the generic Windows 10 Pro key. That's the universal key. You put that in, it will go through the upgrade just like you stated, Martin, but it won't activate when it's done. Now you can put your Windows 10 OEM key in and it will activate. So, and I went through those steps, I believe, last year on how to do that. That's a common method. But if you're on a newer computer that's brand new and 10 Home, it was purchased and that's what was installed from the manufacturer that is built into the BIOS, and you have to use the trick that I talked about, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, it might have been last week, where you have to edit those two files and put them on your media and do the Pro, because it won't ask you for which one you're doing from scratch. And I tried an upgrade from Home to Pro, even using that method that I just said worked, and that didn't work. It is very difficult on a new computer to try to go that was built for Home, Windows 10 Home, and try to get that to Pro. Even from a clean install, you have to use a trick. So the way you're saying to just upgrade and change that key, I've had 0% success rate doing exactly what you described. And I wanted to read this from Martin, and thank you for writing in and letting me know. It depends on the vintage of the machine you're working with in terms of the method that you're going to have to use in order to get from Home to Pro. My best advice is you buy it with Windows 10 Pro if you're getting the system. Even if you're getting refurbished right now, you buy it with Windows 10 Pro. If it's a new system, Pro. Advise your client, don't even buy Home and try to go through that frustrating upgrade process. It's not worth the time. Get Pro right out of the box. That is it for tonight's show. Best way to support the show is to click on my Amazon link in the show notes of every show. That'll take you to Amazon and then add the items to your cart and check out. A small percentage, your price stays the same, comes back to support Carrie Holzman and myself. And it supports Tech Vets and the Mike Tech Show. And we really appreciate, thank you for supporting our shows by using that Amazon link. Fabs Auto Backup 7 Pro, phenomenal. If you got to move any system from any piece of hardware to another, from one operating system to another, that's the best way to do it, and that's Fabs Auto Backup 7 Pro. I want to thank Instant House Call for sponsoring the show. Go to instanthousecall.com, try the 15-day trial, use the code MikeTechShow. That's it. Hope to see everybody back here next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.